Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. In 1993, Chicago's Steppenwolf Theater Company debuted an amazing play with music, which told the story of a young black South African's journey to radicalization during the resistance to apartheid in the 1980s. The Song of Jacob Zulu was a courtroom drama with a Greek chorus supplied by Ladysmith Black Mambazo. It was a hit in Chicago. It then toured Australia and was a hit on Broadway, garnering 6 Tony nominations. But after the production concluded, the play literally disappeared. But the artistic director of Tulsa's World Stage Theater Company saw the original production in Chicago and was blown away by it and knew that she someday wanted to direct a future production. Well, the time has now come, and now Kelly McLeod Shingen has that opportunity as World Stage Theater Company presents The Song of Jacob Zulu, beginning tonight at the Liddy Dungis Theater of the Tulsa Performing Arts Center. Production continues this weekend and next. And next weekend, they'll be joined by Tug Yergrau, the South African emigre playwright, who will participate in a talkback after the February 5th Saturday matinee. She joins us today to talk about this production and how it's based on a true story. Kelly McLeod Shingen, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining
us. Thank you so very much for having me again.
This play, The Song of Jacob Zulu, was nominated for 6 Tony Awards when it debuted on Broadway back in 1994. Yet it literally disappeared after that production ended.
Yeah.
How did you discover the play?
You know, I'll tell you, I saw it at the very beginning because one of my dearest friends was in the original cast. So in 1993, I saw it in Chicago when it was being premiered at the Steppenwolf Theater before it went on tour and then landed on Broadway. And so I got a chance to see it, and I have to say it haunted me from that very moment.
What was special about that production that has stayed with you all these years?
You know, I think it was a number of things. First, it was, if I'm not mistaken, it was very early in my career because now this is like 30 years, right? So I watched it and I thought, I was very surprised by how similar the experience of apartheid Africans were to Black Americans. And we don't get told the stories in that way. We think that our experiences are very unique to us. And even though in the 80s I was one of those students that was out there protesting apartheid, I didn't really know the fullness of the experience that impacted the people who were under the thumb of apartheid. So, or I should say apartheid, as they would say.
Yeah.
And so I think that I was first mesmerized by that, the universality of that experience to oppressed persons. But then it was more than that, it was the music, because it was a play with music, not a musical. And so people didn't just break out into song and dance because the words didn't quite, you know, do it. So it was this incorporation of South African music style in the traditional Greek chorus presentation, right? That they were the narrators, and they were the conscious of the story, and they kept it moving, and they reflected what the people were experiencing.
In fact, for that original production, it was Ladysmith Black Mambazo
who
was singing.
Yeah.
And
so you can't beat that.
Yeah, no. And this is after Graceland, so they were international stars at
Absolutely.
This particular point. And yet they're in this theater production that is commenting on every stage of what is would normally be a traditional courtroom drama.
Yeah.
So obviously it did make an effect on you.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's some certain songs that were a part of it that, as I said, haunted me. You know, there was no soundtrack, there was no album that I could purchase, but there was just the feeling that it left me with. And so for years I thought, you know, if I ever get a chance to audition for that, if it comes around again, because when it leaves Broadway, it usually comes around again. And if I get a chance to audition, I'd love to be in that show. Or if I ever get a chance to direct it, I want to direct that show. So, and it was due in large part to the story and the music and the way that they blend together.
Now we begin to understand why this play disappeared because, you know, you have to have good actors to transmit the drama, but you also have to have a vocal group that can sing in traditional African forms, musical forms. And that's probably a difficult combination to find. How did you find these?
Well, you know, I will say that, you know, they're not South African.
But of course.
Right. But they are really talented vocal musicians. And they were here in Tulsa. We just held an audition, and they showed up and sang. And I think that they do a beautiful job. Our musical director, Brian Jones, worked incredibly hard to try to match that four-part harmony that is unique to the South African blend and four-part harmony that's unique to protest music that comes out of South Africa, which is what this was, right? And so it was incredibly done, but it was hard to do. Many of the parts, the actors, they are playing multiple roles. And so that was also hard. And then to throw in dialect, South African Zulu dialect, and to have them speak in Zulu in a lot of different places that you know, they have to use the clicks, they have to use the different, you know, tonalities that we don't have in our language. And so take some, you know, around the way Okies and do trips like that to their tongue, right? It becomes quite an interesting experience. But they really have risen to the challenge, I have to say.
Well, just from a dialect standpoint, if you go with traditional dialects, then you're not only dealing with Zulu, you're dealing with Afrikaner.
Oh, absolutely. Afrikaner. We have Afrikaner as well.
Yeah, which is a weird amalgam of Dutch and English.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And
we got all of that too.
And it's not even really pure Dutch. It's adulterated.
Right, exactly. Kind of like the language in New Orleans or whatever. What do they call
it? Yeah, patois. It's patois. A patois.
Yeah, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And why was today now the time to do this? Because this play was written at a very interesting point. It was mm-hmm. literally at a transitional point.
Mm-hmm.
Apartheid was ending in South mm-hmm. Africa. The
sure
first
was.
Elections hadn't been held yet.
That's right.
I think it probably were held right at the end of the Broadway run, really.
Yeah. Yep.
So why bring this play back at this particular point?
You know, the bad news is that it's still relevant.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And I think that, interestingly, we wanted to do this production 2 years ago before, you know, our friend called COVID showed up and just threw everything out of the window. And we wanted to make sure that whenever we did it, that we would have critical mass, people to come and see the show. So we held on to it for a couple of years. And in those couple of years, we had things like Michael Brown, George Floyd, and, you know, this global push against systems that oppress, that look at, hold up the mirror to the governments to say, are we who we think we are? And maybe it's time to change. And so I think it's a better time that we're doing it now, even though that wasn't the original intention. But it's so relevant. It's still incredibly timely.
Now, the song of Jacob Zulu is loosely based on a true story of Andrew Zondo, a young member of the ANC's armed wing.
Yeah.
He was radicalized at a relatively young age. He went into exile. He was, I guess, a student and a scholar.
Yeah.
Or was on the way to becoming a scholar.
Absolutely.
And then he became radicalized.
Mm-hmm.
And then he bombed the Amazitoli shopping center in the 1980s
yeah.
in retaliation for the police murders of 9 anti-apartheid activists.
Mm-hmm.
This was something that was happening in South Africa through the 1980s during the, I can't even call it an uprising, but it was acts of armed protest and violent protest against a really repressive regime.
Absolutely.
How closely does the story of Jacob Zulu follow that true story?
It's not verbatim, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's loosely based, but it definitely takes place with a young man who is radicalized, who was following the nonviolent traditions. His father was a minister. He had intentions to become involved in computers and bring that knowledge back to the community to kind of help them grow in that technological opportunity. And so I think it pretty much follows many of the major points, the fact that he bombed a mall and that, you know, the results are the same.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so it takes place as a courtroom drama.
Yes.
But there are flashbacks.
Yes.
And all throughout the play, you have these musical interludes with the Greek chorus commenting on, and really the Greek chorus, I guess, tells as much of the story as what you see through the courtroom drama, because the courtroom drama is one side.
Yeah.
And then I guess a lot of the inner emotions is told through the Greek chorus.
Sure. And then they also ask questions, right? They ask questions about because they're coming from the perspective of the audience as well. You know, did you do it? Did you not do it? Who are you? Right? Who are you? And what are you going to say now? And what did it take for you to confess? Did you confess because you really did it? Or did you confess because they beat this confession out of you? Right? So there's a lot of questions that they're asking in addition to moving the material along, right? And mm-hmm. So it has some traditional aspects of the Greek chorus, and then yet it then steps out a little bit.
How does it differ from a traditional Greek chorus?
Well, I think that in my limited access to Greek chorus, they often functioned as one tight unit, that they would communicate in one voice and move together, you know, almost scuttling across the stage as one body. This chorus, each of them I've invited to take on a character. So who are you? Do you believe that he does it? And because of the fact that these chorus members become a part of the action, are they people who are retelling their access to Jacob? Do you see what I mean? Mm-hmm. So, for example, if one of the chorus members is in a hostel when Jacob arrives at a hostel and he interacts with them and he's having a conversation with he and his the man who basically got him involved in the ANC. And then later on, he's a part of the chorus. He's singing and whatnot. So he's in many ways, I visualize these chorus members when they're acting as in some of the other scenes are then retelling their stories to the audience when they begin to be a part of the chorus.
So you're really changing the focus of a traditional Greek chorus by making them participants in the action. So it becomes a little bit more ambiguous as opposed to a traditional Greek chorus where they're sort of unveiling inner thoughts and inner emotions.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I'd like to say that I was brilliant and did that all on my own, but in many ways it was, you know, offered to us in the stage directions from Tug. It was his vision to make sure that the chorus was as involved in the scenes as they were outside of the scene.
My guest today is Kelly McLeod Shingen, the artistic director for World Stage Theater Company. The group will be presenting The Song of Jacob Zulu by Tug Yergraw, a playwright who had this great hit and then has moved on to television. And it's opening tonight and runs through February 6th. And,
yes.
And she's my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, tell us about some of the folks in the cast.
Oh, we have some wonderful local talent. People like Timothy Hunter, who is the prosecution lawyer. Regretfully, he will not be performing the first weekend because of our friend COVID.
Oh.
However, we do have Adrian Alexander, who will be stepping in as his understudy. We have a brilliant, relative new actor. We found him several years ago. We discovered Chasten Fox, and he is our Jacob. And he has studied this language and this character, and he's read everything that he could on Andrew Zondo. He has watched every video that exists on YouTube about interviews with the family and people who reflect on Andrew Zondo, and has incorporated that into his interpretation of who Andrew Zondo is. And so as a relatively new actor, I think that he really stepped into this world and he embodies what it is that we hoped Jacob would be for us.
Now, how do we get to know Jacob? Is it through the actor himself, or is it through the Greek chorus?
I think it's both, really, uh-huh. Right? I think that he, because the flashbacks are the telling points about who Jacob is. You get to see his family dynamic, his relationship with his brother, his sweetheart girlfriend in the flashbacks that they encounter. And I think that he has some really fantastic moments where he tells you exactly what it is that's on his mind and what he's thinking and how he did and came to do what it was that he did. So I think he tells you, but I think that the chorus kind of plays as the entity that says, did he or didn't he, for the audience, right? Mm. So it's a dance between the two.
So the play actually gets into that motivations and why he did what he did. So there's asides to the audience, I
yes.
guess, from the actor.
Yes.
So what can you share about, without giving too much away, what can you share about this process to radicalization?
Well, I will tell you that it was really observing the murders that would happen. And many of these protests were with unarmed protesters and very young children that would be shot dead by the military or the local police because they were intimidated by South African protests that would use the toy toy. If you're familiar with that, the toy toy is a large mob of people moving in unison, and they're jumping, you know, on each foot, and then they're, you know, shouting in unison too. It's just a shout protest, and it's something that is based in Zulu tradition because it does put fear in the hearts of their enemy. But they were never armed, or mostly never armed, and if they were armed with anything, it was a rock. And so I think that Jacob is observing people who he knew and who he loved and people who look like him being, you know, murdered in the streets, and he just had enough.
Well, it sounds like a very powerful story. Who else is in the cast that we should know about?
Right. So we have the chorus is made up of Justin Daniels, Cornelius Nash. We have Victor Muse and Victor Grimes and Nash McQuarters. And so we have Chris Williams, who is a regular player on the stage here in Tulsa. He plays Jacob's defense lawyer. We have Nick Bushta, who is the judge, and a whole host of other actors, because we have about 30 cast members. And so,
30 cast members.
Not 30. It feels like 30 for me. It's more like 22 or something like that. But it's a lot of people.
Yeah. Well, earlier you were talking about how your prosecutor is out for the first weekend. How have you negotiated the rehearsal process through COVID?
Oh, I have to say that this has been the most difficult experience of my entire 30-year directing career, I have to say, because finding rehearsals that people can all be in at the same time. We were never in the same room together. I honestly don't believe that we have yet had all of the cast members in the room together to this very day. There is always either an understudy, a stand-in, or someone missing because of illness, or they're caring for somebody who was ill, or they're on quarantine because they had contact with someone who was ill. So it's been an awful challenge, frankly, and really takes what is typically a 6-week rehearsal process. We really should have had something like 8 in order to make sure, you know, that everybody was in the room at the same time and prepared. It was beyond difficult to do.
Was there any thought to postponing the performances? I know that's sort of been it's happened so many times over the last 2 years. You set these dates 4 or 5 months and you go, hey, yeah. We should be through Delta. Things should be great by then.
It'll be over by then. It'll only be 2 weeks is what we said about COVID. Yeah. Well, we did think about that. And I think we came to the terms of we're going to keep pushing it back. There's never going to be the right time because this is the time that we're living in right now. So we need to begin to navigate and prepare for. So we got really smart with testing our cast members, making sure everybody was masked. The actors are still masked, you know, as of last night's final dress rehearsal. We're not going to take the masks off until tonight. And even contemplated, do we keep the masks on and figure out a different, you know, clear mask or something so that the audience can see the face? But we've decided that we'll take them off. So it's just forced us to think creatively about things that artists would never have thought about before.
I'm well aware.
Yeah.
Musicians are in the same boat.
I mean,
musicians are becoming public health experts to keep their ensemble safe. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, earlier you were saying, what attracted you to doing this play at this time is the resonance it has for our situation today. Mm-hmm. Now, we don't have so much of the political radicalization, but there are an awful lot of forces out there in our community that are putting our young people of color into situations and outcomes that we don't want to see. What are the relevance to today in your view of this play from the 1990s?
Well, I have to say that what we are not experiencing in the way that South Africa experienced in the 80s and pushback to the apartheid movement is the guerrilla militia. Because the guerrilla militia, the radicalization, I think, of taking up arms is something that we have not yet to do, at least not that I have seen. I know that there are small, very small.
We have seen some serious repression to peaceful protests.
Absolutely.
And, you know, yes, there are windows broken at some time during.
Sure. People who have things. Rocks, not
yeah,
unlike
exactly.
South Africa, right?
Yeah,
but
right.
I think that in terms of the, like some of the movements that have come up as a result of this haven't been organized around a militia spirit. So I think they have organized around, can we change our system? And we will do so politically. And so I think that that's the weapon that they have chosen is to, how do we get people out of office? How do we make sure that we're getting people into office that are being mindful of the oppression that is happening for people and trying to create opportunity, access to opportunity that hasn't been present?
But it is a cautionary tale, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. It's a cautionary tale because I think that, you know, life imitates art, right? So I think that when, I think Dr. King said it the best, right? Riots are the voice of the unheard. And if this community continues to feel, in the United States specifically, that they are unheard, and it constantly is unheard for a long time, then they will start saying, okay, well, what will make you hear me? And regrettably, violence is oftentimes the thing that makes people pause.
Right. Well, we know that the nonviolent protests of the 1960s begat violent protests when not enough progress was made.
That's absolutely
in the 1970s.
Right. Yes, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
My guest today is Kelly MacLeod Shingen, the artistic director for the World Stage Theater Company, who will be opening The Song of Jacob Zulu, a production that was nominated for 6 Tonys when it debuted in Broadway in 1993 and 1994. But this is literally the second production since that production closed,
yeah,
which is pretty amazing for a major Tony-nominated production. They'll be performing it tonight through Sunday at the Liddy Dungeons Theater of the Tulsa Performing Arts Center, and that will continue next weekend, mm-hmm, and which the playwright, Tug Yergraw, will be joining you next week for a talk back after or before the matinee.
Saturday matinee.
Yeah, the Saturday matinee on mm-hmm Saturday, February 5th.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about Tug Yergraw, because you would think after a major nominated play, big, huge success on Broadway, he would continue to write plays. But he moved into television. He worked in public television, producing documentaries for a while. Now he has his own production company. Yeah. He does a few films and things like that. He just left theater.
Yeah, he did. And I think, I believe that he wrote one more play, which I can't recall the name of. Please forgive me, Tug. But I know that a lot of his work then did stay in the television and film area. He did a documentary on a return to South Africa that he did for himself. And I know that he also did a voiceover for some documentaries that were reflecting on the experiences of the families that were impacted by Andrew Zondo, including Andrew Zondo's own family. And so I know that that voiceover work and film and television is where he's been living lately. But I'm not exactly sure what contributed to his not picking up Zulu and taking it further, right? Because as I said before, it started in Chicago at the Steppenwolf, and then it moved.
It went to Australia after that.
Yeah. And then it landed on Broadway. And so it had a great deal of success, as you said. I mean, being nominated for 6 Tonys is nothing to sneeze at. The original cast had people like K. Todd Freeman and Zakes Mokai. And of course, I forget the father of Frasier.
John Mahoney.
Yeah, John Mahoney was also in the original. He was the original Frankel. Mm. And so you have a number of people who were just so instrumental to the production who have all gone on, right, to greater success, right, in television and film as well. So I think when it was all said and done, trying to figure out how do you continue to mount this show without somebody like Ladysmith Black Mambazo, because there wasn't a score for me, right? So when we got the play, we had the lyrics. And we had a couple of leftover recordings from Ladysmith Black Mambazo when they did it. But the rest of the songs we didn't have and didn't have access to because, unfortunately, the former leader of Ladysmith Black Mambazo has gone on. Many of the new members of Black Mambazo are not the original members that were there at that time.
So nobody knows the melodies.
Nobody knows what happened to the music, right?
They could have been very much folk melodies that they just put new lyrics in
for. Yeah, a lot of them were, absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so we ended up tapping into a local musician, Brian Jones, in order to help us to figure out how can we keep the spirit of the songs that we did have and try to recreate a similar sound. And then he also added some songs himself, some that he wrote himself. And so, or I'll say he wrote the melody or composed the melody, yeah. But the lyrics, of course, were co-written by Tug and Ladysmith Black Mambazo. So I think that was a big challenge for a lot of people. And then how do you, because it was certainly more of a challenge than I expected.
Well, now, Tug will be joining you for the talk back after the matinee next weekend.
Yeah.
What are you hoping to learn? What are you hoping to learn about the play and the creation of the play and what he was trying to accomplish?
Well, you know, Tug was born in South Africa, but he left at a young age. I think he was either 10 or 12 years old when he left. So when he went back, he was really surprised, and he had that loving experience of memory of his homeland, but then was really disappointed at the world that had become for him as an adult South Africa.
Well, probably as a white South African.
Oh, absolutely.
He was sheltered for those 10 or 12 years.
Sure, absolutely.
And not aware.
Not completely unaware, right? And then to have a friendship with Joseph Shabalala, who was the leader of Ladysmith Black Mambazo, I think that he was really surprised at what happened and wanted to use theater, as we do, to hold up a mirror to say, this is not okay, and to tell people more of the story because, as I said, most people didn't really know the depth of what was happening during apartheid. We had just heard, you know, end apartheid now and, you know, de-invest, you know, your monies in South Africa. But they really weren't talking about the details.
Just to finish up, going back to the story of Andrew Zondo, Zondo was found guilty and executed.
Yes.
His two co-conspirators were acquitted.
Yeah.
But the security forces, they committed an extrajudicial killing.
Mm-hmm.
They were both murdered by security forces afterwards.
Yeah.
And that was very common in
Absolutely.
South Africa.
Yeah.
So it was a violent, repressive regime. Anyway, Indeed. You can learn more by attending the Song of Jacob Zulu tonight through Sunday and again next weekend as well at the Liddy Dungis Theater. Kelly, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Kelly McLeod-Shingen is the artistic director for World Stage Theatre Company. She'll be directing the company's production of The Song of Jacob Zulu by Tug Yergraw, which opens tonight at the Lindy Dungis Theatre of the Tulsa Performing Arts Center and continues with performances this weekend and again next weekend through February 6th. Tug Yergraw will be joining the company next week for a talkback following the Saturday, February 5th matinee. For information on tickets, visit TulsaPAC.com. That is the Greek Chorus in performance at a local Tulsa restaurant, a pop-up performance. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.
The fire is burning, it lights up the sky, from high on the rock down to the sea. Gambo is taking the children, it is eating future, Gambo, so the fire in your blood, so the fire in your blood. Let it ambu mama, let it ambu baba, let it asingani, lalelaribo. This is a song of a young man called Jacob Zulu.
Zulu.
Who suffered for the sins of South Africa.
South Africa.
Let it ambu baba. Let it ambu mama.